Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Micah Saub, arguing for Cheryl Steele, who's in the galley. Your Honors, the trial courts made three significant errors. As this court noted in its request sua sponte, hinted at in its request sua sponte, when the Supreme Court issued Burlington Northern, that highlighted the first of the trial court's errors. The trial court ignored the applicable standard. For 15 years, Your Honors, Passer versus American Chemical Society has been the governing standard in retaliation cases. The trial court ignored that standard, as well as Burlington Northern, which reiterated the same standard. Second, the court never considered Ms. Steele's hostile environment claim. It took one piece of it, the constructive discharge, determined that there was no constructive discharge, but then rejected the entire hostile environment claim. Third, the court held that some of Ms. Steele's claims were time-barred, even though there was plain evidence in the record demonstrating that she had contacted the EEO office early enough to encompass those claims.
Can we just sort of try to get the decks clear? Are you making, I did not see in your brief a challenge to the conclusion on constructive discharge.
Your Honor, we believe that the constructive discharge question is one that properly belongs to the jury. Certainly.
Well, did you raise that in your brief? That is, did you question the district court's conclusion on that?
I believe we did, Your Honor.
I hope maybe on rebuttal you can tell me where.
Thank you, Your Honor. Now, as to the retaliation claim.
That's more debt clearing.
I'm sorry, was there something more, Your Honor?
Yes, there's another debt clearing issue, and that is the disparate treatment claims. Are you contesting the district court's conclusion, except insofar as it might turn on the bar date issue?
I think that to the extent that we're distinguishing between disparate treatment and hostile environment, the answer is no. We have a hostile environment claim.
Okay.
All right.
Good.
And we have a retaliation claim. And as to the retaliation claim, Your Honors, the trial court explicitly held that Ms. Steele's claims did not rise to the level of an adverse employment action. When this court issued Passer versus American Chemical Society in 1991, it held that it is not necessary to demonstrate an adverse employment action. And of course, the Supreme Court recently endorsed that approach in Burlington Northern. A plaintiff has an actionable claim for retaliation if she demonstrates that the employer's actions were such that a reasonable person would likely have been dissuaded from complaining about discrimination as a result of the employer's actions.
Try to get focus on that. If I understand the record correctly, the first indication that Johnson had any awareness of contact with EEO by the plaintiff is August 30, 1999. Is that correct?
No, Your Honor.
Oh, so
no, Your Honor.
What is there in the record that puts him on notice earlier of such a contact?
Well, the record, I'm not sure that I can say to Your Honor that there is, that I can
We do have in the record that he was told on that date, and we do have in the record that he reacted with surprise, right? It's on the same page. So,
Your Honor, Ms. Steele,
we do need something in the record to make it an earlier date.
Well, I think what we need in the record, Your Honor, is a demonstration that Ms. Steele went to the EEO office, complained about discrimination. Now, their normal routine, as is in this case and as in every case, is to communicate with the employer, the boss. And we know, it is clear in the record, despite the trial court's error, the record clearly demonstrates that the EEO office, by its own admission, spoke with Ms. Steele at the beginning of the year, not the middle of the year.
Oh, I'm sorry. Where is that?
Do you have the page? If you'll just give us a moment.
Okay. I thought we definitely had her statement that she spoke with
Indeed.
EEO in January.
Yes.
But,
the EEO office stated it was, they used the date of February.
That's at 185.
Thank you, Judge. Now, there is clearly some murkiness, Your Honors. Her testimony is, I went to EEO in January. The EEO office says, we talked to her in February. I believe it was a typo, but this is my own speculation. I readily admit that. The reality is, no matter how you cut it, the record clearly demonstrates that Ms. Steele went to the EEO office at the beginning of the year. And for that matter, Your Honor, Ms. Steele's own testimony that she went to the EEO office in January is sufficient. It is the defendant that has the burden of proof to demonstrate that there is no dispute of material fact. And there is no evidence which contradicts Ms. Steele's claim that she went to the EEO office in January. Now, what we do see is retaliatory conduct soon thereafter. For example, Ms. Steele had long nurtured a relationship with a Dr. Tegenye. This ultimately blossomed into a major project, a project so important that it was a significant factor in the ultimate promotion of the woman who was appointed to lead that, not my client, but a Ms. Perry. When Dr. Tegenye first arrived at the agency in January of 1999, Mr. Johnson physically interposed himself between Ms. Steele and Dr. Tegenye. This is an extraordinary act. A jury could certainly conclude that it was an act of retaliation. There were other acts that occurred that demonstrate retaliation. For example, Mr. Johnson was in the habit of giving credit for work that Ms. Steele did to other employees. But in something that can be characterized only as extraordinary, he gave credit to a Mr. Mishra for a paper that Ms. Steele had written. And Mr. Mishra himself...
Is this the meeting of May 1999?
I believe that this was later than that, Your Honor.
There's her testimony with respect to a meeting in May 1999, which speaks of her hearing of some meeting in which he credits Mishra with a paper which she says in the same testimony is in fact hers.
I believe that the giving of credit was done not just a verbal statement by Johnson, but something that was actually in writing. Now, it's important to note that Mishra himself testified, I don't know why I got credit for that.
We talk about getting credit. This was in a meeting.
No, I believe, Your Honor, that it was not in a meeting. My understanding is that it was something in writing.
And at least the account, I think it's pages 219 to 223 or something like that, seems to be of a meeting.
We'll take a look
at
the record.
Maybe there are additional things.
This may well be an additional thing,
sorry,
because I understand that it was
119 to 122.
I understand that what we're talking about here is something that happened later, that happened after the formal charge was filed in June. Later that year, in the August to September time frame, Mr. Johnson selected Janet Perry to be the project leader of that Tennessee State University project involving Dr. Tegenye. Now, Janet Perry was ultimately promoted in large part because of her role in there. Her own application for reclassification makes that clear. Ms. Steele brought that project to the department. Dr. Tegenye wanted to work with Ms. Steele. But despite that, and despite the normal practice in the department, Johnson gave that assignment to Perry. Now, there are other actions. For example, at the beginning of 1999, Johnson denied a special act award to Ms. Steele. And I think what's especially notable and telling about that is that at one point he claimed that her nomination came too late. But in fact, there were other employees who were nominated at the same time who did receive awards. His answer was clearly pretextual. He later changed his mind and said, no, the real reason that I didn't give her the award is that I don't think she deserved it, underscoring the fact that he was giving pretextual reasons. He was inventing reasons for not giving her the award. Likewise, he denied an award to her for her work on the Y2K project. Now, Your Honors, year after year, she is recording on her performance evaluation forms a lot of detail about the work she did on that project. And year after year, Mr. Johnson signs those evaluations. He reads them. He then claims that he didn't know she was working on the Y2K project. Clearly pretextual. Ultimately, Your Honors, the trial judge applied the wrong standard. If the court had applied the correct standard, it would have found that there's ample evidence from which a reasonable jury could have concluded that Johnson's actions were such that it would have dissuaded a reasonable employee under all the circumstances from filing a charge. And I think one of the important factors here is that we've got to look at all of the circumstances, including Ms. Steele's knowledge that Mr. Johnson had assigned an employee to work for her because both she and the employee were black. He made a work assignment based on race. Strikes me as a prima facie violation, Title VII. And he did it because he knew that that employee, whose name is Bessie Jones, he knew that she wanted to file a claim of discrimination. Ms. Steele was aware that if she were to file a charge of discrimination against her boss, something bad could happen to her, just as it happened to Ms. Jones.
Let's go back to this issue of notice to Johnson of the complaint or the informal contact. Isn't it the case that the EO counselors are supposed to keep the informal contacts confidential?
No, Your Honor. I think the reason for that initial contact is...
I'm not talking about the reason for the initial contact. I'm talking about practice. I understood you to say that assuming that she contacted the EO counselor in January or February of 99, then we can automatically infer notice of that to Johnson. I'm questioning that.
Yes, Your Honor, the reason for... Well, let me say this. Ms. Steele contacted the EEO counselor earlier, but asked specifically that it be kept confidential. The purpose...
That seems to be a second reason why we should not infer that he was on notice.
No, Your Honor. As I was going on to say, the reason for making that contact, the reason that Congress has required this sort of framework is to provide an opportunity for early resolution through the intervention of the EEO office. That's statutory. So when she went to the EEO office, the purpose was, can we get this resolved? Now, when she went earlier, she did specifically request that it be kept confidential. But that's a distinction from the January contact that she had. That January contact, she did not ask that it be kept confidential. And in fact, it apparently wasn't, because almost immediately thereafter, Mr. Johnson ratcheted up his campaign against her. Things went from bad to worse at that point. I do not believe, Your Honor, that there's any indication in the record or elsewhere that that meeting was supposed to be confidential. And in fact, I think that we'll find in the EEOC compliance manual, for example, that that's not the case.
Let me go back to, I'm sorry, I've been flipping around through the record here because I couldn't remember something. In the statement of material facts not in genuine dispute, I'm looking at
the... I beg your pardon, Your Honor, you mean the agency statement?
Statement of material facts not in genuine dispute.
That's the agency statement, Your Honor?
I'm looking at DA 0048. The agency says in paragraph 66, plaintiff did not contact an EEO counselor about this matter until June 1999, and I can't find anywhere in your filing in response to that, in plaintiff's list of material facts in dispute, where you denied that. So what are we to make of that?
Your Honor, this court reviews the matter de novo. As the court may be aware, we did not represent Ms. Steele below, so I can't speak with great knowledge as to what happened there.
I beg your pardon? It still turns on what is contested.
Well, it does
in
indeed.
A standard manner.
Right. I understand that. It's clear in this court hears the matter de novo. So the fact that Ms. Steele did or did not contest it before the trial court does not bind this court's hands.
Well, the record clearly demonstrates.
That's not true.
So we have cases that say that a district court is entitled to rely on the procedural rules about denial when the other side makes a genuine issue of material facts statement. However, we've also said that when the district court doesn't rely on that rule as the justification for the district court's decision, then that's not the ground. Now, as I understand it, on JA 73, the plaintiff actually does contest this point, but apparently not in its response to the genuine issue of material facts.
Well, that's right. I was going to go on to say, Your Honors, that the record that the trial court had clearly demonstrated that Ms. Steele had filed earlier and did not agree that the December date.
The court didn't hold that he was going to rely on the failure to contest the genuine issue of material facts statement.
No, that wasn't the basis.
Did the defendants argue that he was bound by that?
The defendants did not argue that in this proceeding at all. The fact is, the defendants claimed that it was in dispute. Clearly, the record demonstrated that it was in dispute. It wasn't done artfully, but it was in the record.
Right. You're out of time unless the panel has further questions.
I appreciate the time. Thank you.
May it please the court, good morning. Alan Birch on behalf of the defendant, Appellee. This court reviews the matter de novo, but that does not mean that it gives the opposing party license to simply reformulate whatever pleadings could have been improved upon below. This court's role is to step into the role of the district court and look at the papers that were presented to the district court on summary judgment. That analysis is properly framed by looking at the defendants, the moving parties, statement of material facts, the evidence in support thereof, and critically, the evidence that was offered in opposition to each of those statements by the plaintiff.
So you're throwing away the district court's opinion altogether?
You owe the district court's opinion no deference, and
well,
so...
Maybe I need to do a little deck clearing myself. It seems to me that the district court actually made four errors of law, and I just wanted to see it rather than just three, and I wanted to see whether you agreed with me.
Okay.
So... in footnote 3, which is the one in which the court says it's going to resolve the discrepancy with respect to the date of the first filing,
right.
The court acknowledges that there is a discrepancy in the record. Now, normally when the judge acknowledges there's a discrepancy in the record, that means there is a genuine issue of material fact.
Well, only if the fact is material, Your Honor. It doesn't change the outcome, however.
Don't you think... For purposes of this opinion, leave aside what we might do totally starting all over and pretending there was no district court.
Sure.
The date that the district court picked as the first date for retaliation purposes was certainly material to the court's opinion, wasn't it?
Not within the range that it was selecting from, Your Honor, because even if you pick the earlier January date, the only claim that would arguably have a different analysis is the Y2K claim. The other claims arose far before 45 days previous to January,
About the argument about the putting the hands in the face during the January meeting?
But that wasn't the, well.
What about the argument about the unemployment insurance, all the various other things?
But those came later, Your Honor.
What about the one in January then? Wasn't there a meeting in January?
But Your Honor, that was not, I don't believe that that was brought to the process at that time. I think it was brought to the administrative process much later. So.
Right, but this is on the retaliation question, right? So if the first date that they went, that she went to the EEO was January, at least it's possible that events that occur after January would be retaliation. If the first date that she went was June, then events prior to June wouldn't count. Are you saying there are no events between January and June?
I'm saying it wouldn't change the analysis of the exhaustion, whether she went to the brought to the EEO process at the right time.
I'm not
it may
about,
change the
I'm not
question.
Talking about exhaustion,
okay.
About retaliation. Right.
Sure. In terms of when the deciding official was put on notice, sure, it could theoretically change that analysis. But again, we get back to Judge Williams' point, which is you need to show that the deciding official had knowledge for the claims to
well,
count.
Well, that may be, but that's again, I'm. This is a whole set of arguments, so I don't know whether they were raised below at all. They certainly weren't raised by the district court. So first, let me ask about the district court.
Okay.
The district court simply found a date, June as being the date.
Well, it had good reason for that date, Your Honor.
It had good reason. I'm just asking whether there was a dispute about that date.
I don't believe that there was a material dispute, Your Honor. If you look at the opposition that was raised to the date, but if their statement of material fact, or their opposition to the statement of material facts, I should say, then there is no opposing evidence that is credible on that.
The judge says that the reason he's choosing June 18th is because it was admitted, among other reasons, admitted by Steele in her response to the USDA's request for admissions.
Right. There was also...
I'm just asking, again, mm-hmm. I want to limit myself. I'll let you make a whole new argument never made before and never decided by the district court if you want to, but I first want to know what the district court said. When I look at 73, it's not as the judge represented.
I'm sorry, when you look?
On JA 73, paragraph 8, it says the plaintiff, these are the responses to the USDA's request for admissions, and it says the plaintiff contacted an EEO counselor for the first time in January 1999.
June 1999.
So that's not, it's not even an accurate reason, but it certainly sounds like from the district court's point of view, there are a set of facts here that district court was resolving.
Your Honor, the footnote says the June 18th, 1999 comes from her complaint in federal court.
And
then he acknowledges.
And admitted by Steele in her responses. Right? That's the remainder of the sentence.
Steele, I'm reading from JA 705, footnote 3.
The court uses the June 18th, 1999 date because that mm-hmm. is the date alleged by Steele in her complaint and admitted by Steele.
I see, yes. That is a mistake, but it's entirely inconsistent with what the court wrote in the first couple sentences of the footnote. I mean, the court gets it right in the first part where it claims that it notes the admission in her complaint, and then in the second sentence acknowledges that she says in her request for admissions that she contacted the EEO counsel the first time in January.
Right. So he and then he goes on and recognizes a discrepancy.
Yes.
Well, normally when there's a discrepancy, particularly with respect to something that's within the knowledge of the plaintiff, the district court doesn't resolve that.
But, Your Honor, the plaintiff herself has taken inconsistent positions, and she pled it in her complaint, and the complaint should be taken as binding unless the plaintiff seeks to amend it.
Well, there's a very divided law on that subject, even in our own circuit, as you're nodding, you probably know. Sometimes we say that when the issue is contested on summary judgment, that's an implied amendment.
Right.
Sometimes we say you can't make that implied amendment, and our cases don't appear to be really consistent on this point.
Well, with all due respect, Your Honor, it puts the defendant in a very difficult position, and it's somewhat unfair to hold the defendant to the worst-case scenario generated by the plaintiff's inconsistencies.
Well, you could, I mean, in a deposition, you could ask, what is the basis for your claim that you went in January? If her answer is, I went in January, then you're stuck. I mean, that's...
But that's the whole point, Your Honor. That's the inconsistency generated by the plaintiff.
Right, but...
Therefore, it's perfectly reasonable for the district court to rely on the documentary evidence.
It would be reasonable for a jury. I mean, I don't think the case law says that when a party is inconsistent, for purposes of summary judgment, you always take the worst position for the party. Is there a case law that says that?
Not aware of that, Your Honor.
Let me ask about the other points that seem to me wrong in the district court's opinion.
Okay.
At 707, in describing untimely events used to support her claim that she was subject to a hostile environment, the next sentence says, absent either evidence or argument that Steele is entitled to the benefit of equitable tolling, the court agrees with the USDA. Steele is entitled to no relief on any of her claims that arose more than 45 days before. Now, under Morgan, the Supreme Court's opinion, in fact, isn't she right that as long as she has one timely event within the period, that she can rely on the other untimely events?
Only for a hostile environment
That's
claim.
What this is. This is a sentence is only about hostile environment, right? I'm reading the sentence that says she suggests instead that the...
There needs to be some, doesn't there need to be some connection between the events that would make them have to be a continuous...
Yes. It has to be a hostile environment.
Mm-hmm.
Now, maybe he's concluding there is no hostile environment, but that's not what it sounds like.
These all sound as claims that are, examples of disparate treatment, examples that are of individual actions. I mean, what's the link other than the same employee and the same job?
Well, now you're asking me a different question,
yeah.
Right? I want to first focus on what the district court did. Now,
okay.
If you want to argue that there's not enough evidence for a hostile environment, that's fine.
Right.
And you did argue that below.
Right.
But that's not what the district court held. The district court held, one, that the complaints about hostile environment aren't timely, and it seems like they're holding that in the face of Morgan. And second,
That's right, Your Honor.
All right. And then also with respect to hostile environment, I don't see any other discussion of hostile environment except the discussion about constructive discharge. And the standards for those for that, you would agree, is different than the standard for hostile environment.
Yes, Your Honor.
Because that one requires so intolerable and plus aggravating circumstances.
Well, Your Honor, the district court was being generous in terms of how it interpreted the hostile work environment claim because of the nature of the complaint in the case. The complaint does not allege hostile work environment. The complaint simply...
We'll get to that in just one second. I just want to see what the district court actually said. And the third thing
I think that explains why it was fair for the district court to limit that.
I promise I'll give you a chance.
Okay.
And the last one is the adverse employment action. You agree, I take it, that the district court's wrong with respect to what's required for retaliation.
Yes, the standard is the Morgan-Rochon standard, both of which postdated the district court's decision.
The standard is what? Not Morgan.
Burlington.
I'm sorry. Burlington Northern. Yeah, Burlington Northern.
And Rochon was after?
I believe so. Wasn't Rochon 2006?
What about Passer, which Rochon relied on? And does it make any difference anyway?
I don't believe it makes any difference, Your Honor.
It doesn't matter whether it's before or after, right? If the Supreme Court has decided what the standard is, that's the standard.
That's right, Your Honor.
As long as we're still on direct appeal on this.
Right. And I don't believe that to the extent there's a difference in the analysis that it would result in a different conclusion here. That's the point we make in our brief. Even under the Burlington Northern standard, none of these alleged actions of retaliation would rise to the level.
Okay, now to the point that you wanted to make, which was about the hostile environment. You did argue that below about hostile environment, work environment, didn't you? You treated the complaint as if it were raising a hostile environment claim.
Yes, although we did note down below that the complaint didn't appear to be doing that, but that we would nevertheless go ahead and address the merits of it.
And it does refer to in the remedy section of the complaint, although it's hard to tell.
Right, but that's the only reference where she requests reassignment to a quote less hostile environment.
Right.
That's the only reference in the complaint to a hostile environment theory of any kind. She makes no attempt to explain which acts she thinks defined the hostile environment, when it began.
But this is only a complaint. In a complaint, you don't generally have to list every act of the hostile environment.
You do need to put the defendant on notice as to what they have to defend against, Your Honor.
Well, she said that this was a discrimination complaint, and the hostile environment is a form of discrimination.
There are many forms and many theories that could come.
There are. And then she used the word in the remedy section. They said that they wanted to remedy the hostile environment. You obviously were concerned enough about it that you devoted a considerable portion of your paper below to the issue. Is that wrong?
No, we wanted to be thorough and complete, Your Honor.
You said to the extent that she raises a hostile environment claim.
Yes,
I think
exactly.
All your passages on that are introduced by language of that
That's
sort.
Right, Your Honor. If I may, closer scrutiny of the...
Do you acknowledge that it was a mistake for the district court not to discuss hostile environment in its disposition?
No, Your Honor. As I believe noted in the brief in passing, we believe the district court was generous in its treatment of the hostile work environment claim, and that was appropriate, that given the complaint and the way the case had been prosecuted below, that was an appropriate analysis. The court of this case, I believe, is to scrutinize the evidence.
But the district court didn't address the hostile environment claim. I mean, your argument is that the constructive discharge claim was, in fact, hostile environment. Is there any other place where the district court addressed the hostile environment claim? There must not be, because
no.
you used the constructive discharge to say that it was.
Right. Exactly, Your Honor. If I may, Your Honor, the key to this case is looking at the evidence that she's put forth to support the opposition to summary judgment. That is where the weaknesses appear time and time again. We could pick one of the claims and go through it if you like. It's really quite straightforward over and over again. For example, with respect to the, the Y2K award, the only argument she made in opposition to the date as to when she contacted the EEO counselor appears at the appendix page 344 in her opposition paragraph 44. And she cites nothing that would establish
a
date.
Are you talking about this with respect to an individual discrimination claim or with respect to retaliation or with respect to hostile work environment when you mention that particular one?
With respect to all of them, actually, but she needs to show the timing as to when she brought the claim to the EEO office, and that was the point of the defendant's statement of material fact. The evidence she cited in contravention of that was merely a 45-page stack of her annual reports with no pinpoint site therein. And if you dig through there, the last couple of them mention her 98 and 99 job descriptions. She mentions that she's working on Y2K issues. That does nothing to rebut the defendant's statement of material fact. And so it goes over and over again through each of the claims. There's a claim well made and well supported by evidence and the statements of material fact by the defendant. There's a weak opposition, if there's any at all, with the evidence that barely even clashes, much less generates a material dispute of fact. And if you go through the claims one at a time, I'm confident you'll reach the same result as the district court. And
do you understand them to be appealing with respect to the discrimination claims?
Excuse me?
Do you understand the plaintiff's brief as appealing with respect to the discrimination claims as compared to the retaliation and the hazardous work environment?
Hostile work environment claims. My understanding is that they are bringing retaliation claims and the hostile work environment claim on appeal.
And not the individual discrimination claims. They're not.
I think that's the best reading, but again, I want to be complete. It's not crystal clear to me.
I'll see if I can clear it up on rebuttal.
You should be well.
That was the question.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Mr. Sal, maybe you can clear that up for me and I think the panel. I had understood your brief as not actually raising on appeal the individual claims of discrimination, of adverse employment action. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And you're not also raising the constructive discharge?
Your Honors, we intended to do so.
I went back on after your colloquy with Judge Williams. I don't see any of that in the brief either.
Well, I will readily concede that we've done so poorly that we did not squarely address it. Our view was that it was a jury question. The jury should be addressing it. If you look at our briefs at pages 30 and 33, you'll see reference to it.
I thought that was reference to the difference between hostile work environment and constructive discharge.
Well, I guess what I mean, the language of the brief makes clear reference to the termination, unless I'm misunderstanding the question. We did, in our brief, squarely address the termination. We did allege that it was part of the hostile environment, and I think an act of retaliation. I'm sorry?
Yeah, but with respect to the separate claim, the specific claim about constructive discharge, right, you have to prove a situation so intolerable that no reasonable person would continue working there, and you also have to prove aggravating circumstances, right?
Right.
Okay. Now, did you make the argument here that that's what this case was about?
We did not, Your Honor.
I thought your argument was maybe we're not that, but we are a hostile work environment, and you were saying the district court erred in applying a higher standard.
Well, there's no question about that, Your Honor. We did not make the specific argument regarding these are the standards of law that you've got to satisfy to have a constructive discharge. But there's no question that the judge applied the wrong standard in saying if a constructive discharge is the entirety of a hostile environment claim, and if we know what the standard is for a constructive discharge, you don't get there. That's wrong. I mean, it's just plain and simple wrong. The standard,
what's wrong exactly?
The standard for a constructive discharge is, without question, substantially higher than the standard for a hostile work environment.
Right.
The only event which the trial court explored vis-a-vis the hostile work environment was the constructive discharge. And the court correctly set out the standard for a constructive discharge. It said you have to show this and you have to show the aggravating circumstances. And you don't have aggravating circumstances. Well, we do not claim to have aggravating circumstances as to the entirety of the hostile environment claim. And even if we have no aggravating circumstances as to her constructive discharge, we do meet the hostile environment claim. The circumstances were sufficiently severe or pervasive so as to cause the working conditions to be affected.
That's hostile work environment.
That's hostile environment.
Not constructive discharge.
Yes, Your Honor. We do not meet the standard, perhaps, of a constructive discharge, but we certainly do meet the standard for a hostile work environment. I seem that I'm out of time. I can address a couple of the issues that were raised if the court wishes. I think one in particular is this issue of whether Ms. Steele was inconsistent regarding the dates. There is no inconsistency. Ms. Steele has consistently said yes.
Well, there's an inconsistency with the complaint, isn't there?
No, Your Honor. I don't believe so. I think that she has certainly said that she went to the EEO office in June, and that is when she filed.
It's not inconsistent with going in January or the previous June.
It is not. She said, I went there in June, and that's when I filed my formal complaint. Did she say, I also went there in January? No, she didn't think it was necessary. Should she have? Perhaps she should have. But as a matter of law, there's no inconsistency.
That doesn't work for the passage of page 48 of the appendix. Plaintiff did not contact an EEO counselor about this matter until June 18, 1999. Until.
The defendant, Your Honor, was well aware that Ms. Steele had stated in her answers, in her admissions, response to the request for admissions.
This statement, which I believe is not refuted in her response to this document, clearly says not until. So that the point that a complaint in June is not inconsistent with a complaint in January is irrelevant to that.
I'm hesitant to concede. We're on page 48 in paragraph 61. If I'll just take a quick look here, pages stuck together. There we go. Yes, what appears to be, well, no, perhaps it's not. I was about to say it appeared to be an oversight. We go from paragraph 60 to 62. So
we're
it's,
talking about 66.
Yeah, it's true. It certainly is true, Your Honor, that at the court below, she did not specifically refute that in terms of the statement of material facts.
In the document that
right.
is but designed for that purpose.
I agree, Your Honor. I certainly agree. But her lawyer's oversight in that regard, when the record clearly demonstrates that she did not only her own testimony, as the defendant would have you believe, but also the EEO office, the testimony is clear. The record is clear that she was there at the beginning of the year. And her lawyer's error in that regard should not change the truth of the matter. I understand that there are times where a lawyer's admission is binding on a litigant. This should not be one, Your Honors. It would be a shame for her to be denied a remedy because the defendant makes a false statement to the court, an erroneous statement to the court, and the lawyer doesn't address it.
Okay, we have your argument.
Thank you so much, Your Honor.
Very much, both sides.